I'd like to once again greet everybody in the room and out on the internet. We appreciate being able to share this time with you. It was a hectic week for me. I made my annual trek to Cincinnati on Thursday to teach a class at Ambassador Bible Center. They have a class called Comparative Religion, in which they go through all of the, well, I mean, all is an all-inclusive word, but let's say the majority of the major religions, both Christian and Eastern religions, and do a comparative study. And there is a segment in that on Amish Mennonite history. So I've been going down there. Actually, I think I've gone every year since ABC began to teach on that. And one of the things that I mentioned in the two-hour class, I mean, the second half, what I covered was, what is an Amish wedding like? You know, how is it done? You know, what are the particulars? You know, aside from food, which any of you that have been to an Amish wedding knows that there is an overabundance of food. And actually, down in our area, people that are not Amish look forward to an Amish neighbor getting married so that they will get an invitation to partake of all the food. But another thing that is part and parcel of the ceremony is, and that's how this ties into what we're about to do, is a review of the biblical narrative. In the ceremony that goes from 8:30 in the morning until high noon, there is a sermonette that's typically 20 to 30 minutes long, and then a sermon that is much longer. They cover the biblical narrative beginning with creation, in the case of the sermonette, through the Noachian flood. The actual ceremony then picks up with the story of Abraham and goes forward through the Egyptian captivity, the Exodus into and through the period of Judges, and then the wedding ceremony itself revolves around the apocryphal Book of Tobit. And, I mean, there are scripture readings out of the New Testament as well. And it reminded me that because of that, and because I had numerous aunts and uncles, and I mean, my earliest memory of an Amish wedding was when my one uncle got married, and I must have been 2 or 3 years old. But let's just say I went to many of these weddings over the years. And while you sat there on hard benches and endured the time, and I won't tell you about some of the entertainment that young Amish boys invent in order to, you know, make the time go by, because this can be rather interesting or boring depending on the speaker, who either chooses to make it mundane or interesting, depending on, you know, it's a personality issue. But here's what it left me with. It left me, and I never really thought about this. It was just part of my upbringing. It left me with a pretty clear timeline, if you will, of the biblical narrative, because you would get it delivered to you in chronological form, in narrative form. There are other times throughout the year that this is done. One is at communion services, which is held twice a year, but bringing that back to what we've been doing and going through what we called at Ambassador the Thread of the Bible, or as I have titled this series of studies, God's Timeline of History, I think it is important for us to have a good understanding of the biblical narrative, as it does some important things here. I'm going to turn off my phone so we don't have a surprise. Okay. Sorry about that. It does something, I think, important for us. I never had any doubt in my mind, having heard it so many times, that Adam and Eve were real, that Noah actually built a boat, that Abraham left his fatherland and went into this land of Canaan and had sheep and goats and herds and gold and silver and so on and so forth, where in our modern culture today, I think we have been taught to look at those things skeptically. So as we go through, you know, we are down. We concluded the last time with the Abrahamic promises and his departure from his fatherland in Genesis chapter 12. And I'd like to pick up the study today in what is called the Fourth Administration, or number 25 on your outline, and begin with the covenant of circumcision. And, you know, I'm taking a little bit more time, and hopefully it'll be interesting and not boring, and and, you know, Freeman can maybe give you some insight on, you know, the entertainment portion. I won't waste any of my time from the pulpit. Freeman, I'm sure, never participated, but was, I'm sure, a observer of such things, and his memory should be keen enough to still give you some of the details. So let's go over to Genesis chapter 17. But as we do this, I think it's important to understand that these were real people. I mean, not only did they exist, which, again, our culture takes pains to deny, and yet the archaeological record continues to penetrate further. We're going to Genesis chapter 17. You kind of know the direction of where we're going. Not only were they real people that actually existed, not just, you know, some imaginary story that somebody made up. I mean, when you think about that, you know, does that make any sense? People made up these stories. You know, why? You know, for what purpose? You made up the story of Abraham, and he never existed. I mean, it was just some invention. I mean, it tells you something, I think, insightful about the individuals that work from that premise. You know, people, fundamentally, people think other people think the way they think. I mean, have you ever noticed that? You think other people think the way you think. And then if you take the time to ask, you are surprised that they don't. I mean, but an individual that comes up with this premise, and it's not just an individual, I mean, it is pervasive thought, that these stories were made up. What does that tell you based on the premise of what I just thought? They make up stories about the past. You call it evolution, okay? Why would you make up a story like that? You know, why make up a story about an old guy that left his fatherland and, you know, couldn't have kids? And it really makes no sense. I mean, obviously, stories, I think, I mean, in fairness, stories change down through time and they are embellished. I'm not suggesting that that's the case with the Bible. But, you know, as in my case, as we retell the stories of our recollections of, you know, generations past, I'm sure that there are certain inaccuracies that come up simply because, you know, how a person remembered something maybe a little bit different from what in actuality it was. But, I mean, in general, you know, the generational story of my family history, for example, I mean, I think in general, it's accurate. What's different about the Bible, in my view, is that it is, if you look at the detail, and we will take a look at some of these things. Number 26 was the covenant of promise. Notice in chapter 17, and I'll read excerpts of this. When Abram was 99 years old, have you ever noticed the precision with which the Bible records and documents this? I mean, why bother telling us how old this old guy was at this particular event? I can tell you why. Because God inspired it to be recorded so that in the future it has more credibility. 99 years old, Abraham, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and will multiply you exceedingly. Then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, as for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be a father of many nations. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you a father of many nations. And of course, he had no child. I mean, this was a contradiction in itself. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, he had no child through Sarah. Notice all the, you know, this is leading up to the covenant of circumcision, but notice all of these things that are included in this promise. I will make you exceedingly fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. Also, I give to you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. I mean, coming from God, this is a powerful promise, extending to our time. And I will give you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession. I will be their God. And God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant and your descendants after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant, which you shall keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male child among you shall be circumcised. And you shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. And he who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male child in your generations. He who is born in your house or bought with money from a stranger who is not your descendant, he who is born in your house and he who is brought with you, your money, must be circumcised. My covenant shall be with you in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And then, of course, in verse 15, we have the fact that, you know, Sarah had not had any children. Let me see, dropping down to verse 23. You know, this is characteristic of Abraham. So God asks him to do a, shall we say, painful thing. And there's no argumentation, there's no big discussion, why, wherefore, and how, and, you know, why do you make me do this? Verse 23, so Abraham took Ishmael and his son, all who were born in his house, and all who were bought with his money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and circumcised the flesh of their foreskins that very same day, as God had said to him. And Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, and Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. That very same day Abraham was circumcised, and his son Ishmael, and all the men of his house. Notice the repetition here. It was the very same day he acted. No discussion. It's also interesting that Ishmael was circumcised at age 13, which, you know, later on became kind of the age of adulthood. You know, teenagers are a modern invention. Sorry, teens. You know, you didn't exist as a class until about, you know, I don't know, the 60s or something is when we invented teenagers. Before then, they were considered adults at that young age. And again, I think that is indicative of our time. Now, it's not my purpose, you know, we're supposed to kind of move through this. It's not my purpose to go into, you know, all the differences between the Old and the New Covenant and circumcision and uncircumcision. That's a discussion for the New Testament. But this was a hallmark event in God's timeline of history. Flesh was cut, blood was let to seal a covenant, which is always the case in the Bible. When a covenant is established, flesh is cut. And in doing so, all of these promises that, again, extend to our time were sealed. Let's go to the next one. You know, Isaac, the son of promise, over in Genesis chapter 21. Genesis chapter 21. Verses 1 through 6, and, you know, just as an aside, you know, I remember, you know, in our wedding, the bishop in his sermon preceding the ceremony would extemporaneously recite all of these events. They had to memorize it because they would not use a Bible, which is a bit of a challenge. And of course, the bishop that married Susan and I was known for his embellishments to the story to make it interesting. You know, he recounted one time, I mean, the story of Rebecca coming to meet Isaac, and she had been on this camel. And the embellishment was that, and, you know, and I can just see her sliding down the back of the camel and run to the tent. So, anyway, that you know, then later I read in the Bible and found out that, you know, it didn't quite happen that way, almost. But, you know, it kind of enhanced the story. So, anyway, I guess I didn't have to tell you that. Genesis chapter 21, let's see here. Yeah, Genesis chapter 21 and verse 1. And the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. And Abraham called his son, who was born to him, whom Sarah bore to him, Isaac. Then Abraham circumcised his son, Isaac, when he was 8 days old, as God had commanded him. Notice the narrative. I mean, this, again, is a very significant event on God's timeline of history. I mean, if Isaac had not been born, it would be a very different world. But there is an embedded argument in here. The Lord visited Sarah as he had said. Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. So the what is embedded into this story is a message about the reliability of God. And notice something else that's interesting. You know, they could still do math back then because it says that Abraham was 100 years old. You know, I mean, there are all kinds of arguments out there when you begin reading the arguments that are made to try to discredit the notion that Abraham was an actual person, and Isaac and Jacob. I mean, I consider it a blessing to have never, I never doubted that. I mean, to me, I mean, that was something that I just accepted to be true. And I feel like it, and like it's been a benefit. Now, that, of course, makes me a intellectually challenged pastor. Naive. That would be the word in our culture. I don't think it's naive at all. I think it is actually rather enlightening to have confidence that this is true. Genesis chapter 26. And here you had the appearance of God to Isaac in verse 2. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land which I shall tell you." And this is in contrast to what we will read later, where God told Jacob to go down to Egypt. The thing that is consistent in these three generations, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, is that when God spoke, they obeyed. "Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you, for to you and your descendants I give all these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father, and I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed." Because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. Now, that's a generational heritage, isn't it? All these things God now would do because Abraham obeyed. And, you know, and as things progress, there are elements of the promise that become unconditional, that are no longer reliant upon the behavior of subsequent generations. Rather, it becomes an issue of God's agreement with Abraham to deliver on his promise to Abraham, and he did, and he has, and I believe that you and I are the recipients of that very promise. Because ultimately it extended, as if we get that far, as we find in Genesis chapter 49, when Jacob, Isaac's son, prophesied on what would occur in the latter days. So, in verse 6, Isaac dwelled in Gerar. Now, we'll jump forward to Genesis 28 to look at the promises given to Jacob. Genesis chapter 28. And again, I'm skipping across a lot of details. I suppose you could make an entire study just of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That would be, I mean, if you wanted to go into all the details of what happened. And what I find is, you know, if you study the problems of, the problems, challenges, and the feats and failures of those three generations, there is a lot to be learned. Genesis chapter 28. I'm in Exodus, that's why it didn't look right. How did I jump forward that far? Genesis chapter 28, In verse 10, now Jacob went out from Beersheba. You know, what I've skipped over, and I'll just mention it so you get the context. You know, Jacob was ever ambitious, and he had an enterprising mom that put him up to it, and he actually lied in order to receive the birthright that was due him. And that caused a rift between him and his brother, and he had to leave. So he fled, and he went out from Beersheba and went toward Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night. And because the sun had set, and he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and your descendants. Now, there are those people that have reasons to deny this. And if you look at the eternal conflict in the Middle East, I mean, this is, you know, it is not a conflict between a couple peoples. It is a conflict between God and certain peoples. And the question is whether or not God will orchestrate world events in such a way that he delivers on his promise, or whether by denying the existence of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the Jews in Jerusalem, we can somehow make this all go away. I know which side I'm going to wager if I would wager. I mean, it is so easy for God to inspire a certain political individual one way or the other to do something or cause a certain set of circumstances to come about to then deliver on his promise. I mean, it's not even a question. He said the message is consistent here. He said to Abraham, he told Isaac, and he repeated it to Jacob, but this land I will give to your descendants. And it became unconditional. Also, your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. And you shall spread abroad to the west and the east, to the north and the south, and in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. I mean, there's a race component to that, and there's a grace component to those blessings. Obviously, Jesus Christ, and this is generally accepted, you know, Jesus Christ was of the seed of Abraham, and there is the blessing of grace that comes from that. But there's the physical generational component of this that is related to race, which says that these descendants that now, notice, it's different. You know, I don't know if you count the granules of dust or if you look to the sky to see the stars in heaven. I don't know if anybody's ever tried to quantify that, but it's a lot. It says that your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth, and these descendants would be a blessing. And if you look at the Western European democracies and the Scandinavian countries and the United States in particular, in Canada and Australia, you can search the historical record of man and you will not find any other example in history where a group of people, you know, when you think about it, you know, we're 300 million people, and if you look at the population of, you know, England and Scandinavia, United States, Canada, and Australia, what we would identify as Israelite countries. So, I mean, I don't know the number. Maybe it is 600 million. I mean, it is, which that ironically would be a tithe. And again, don't quote me on that number. I know the population of the U.S. I just don't know what the rest are. But if you look at the impact that we have had on the latter in the latter days on the entirety of the world, what God was telling us here, or telling Isaac here, or Jacob rather, has come true. I mean, we have been, for all our faults, and they are many, an unparalleled blessing. I mean, if you look at what United States and England did in the past century in the two world wars, twice conquering the madmen, should we say, of Europe, and then just turning it back over to the people. I mean, that is not the way normal conquest works. You know, if you witness what has been going on in the Ukraine over the past number of weeks, generally speaking, you know, when you conquer a land, you occupy and you pillage. And of course, Russia was notorious for that in the East. I mean, having lived in Germany, you know, right around the time after the wall came down, and personally witnessing the disparity between Eastern and Western Germany, I mean, it was stark. You know, when I visited East Germany, even in the 90s, and you looked at what the architecture looked like and what people had, it was reminiscent of what I remember in my very early age in the Amish community, you know, when people were still cooking on top of wood-fired stoves and stuff. I mean, that was still, after World War II, nothing really changed. They just took from it. So, you know, God has a way of making those things come to pass. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you. This doesn't sound like a story somebody would make up, does it? This sounds much more like a very real person being spoken to by a very real God. Jacob woke up from his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." And he was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place! This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Then Jacob rose early in the morning, took the stone that he had put at his head, and set it up as a pillar, and poured oil on top of it, and called the name of the place Bethel. And that location still exists today. We had a quick dinner with Randy and Linda Stiver before we came back Thursday evening. And by the way, they apologized for all the snow that they inflicted upon all of you. So I said, "Well, maybe we invite you in the summer." And I said, "Well, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe you'll bring a tornado or something." but they did send their greetings. I was going to say something about what he said, and I don't remember what it is now. Genesis chapter 30. Then we have the 12 sons of Jacob. You know, Jacob meets Rachel and gets Leah instead. If this were a made-up story about, you know, patriarchs of old, that wouldn't you have rather made it up and made them and turned them into saints? I mean, just kind of polished them off. You know, Jacob, I mean, he had a real problem. I mean, first of all, you know, he was reaping what he had sown earlier. You sow deception, you reap deception. So, you know, he had labored for 7 years, and finally thought that, you know, he was getting his lovely wife, and woke up the next morning to find out it was somebody else. I guess that would have been quite a trip. So he got the other woman, so he has two, and then they embraced the culture of the day, and, you know, he got two bonuses as well, and the handmaidens. Now, you know, I'm sure some young guys are thinking, well, this isn't so bad, until you look at the practicality of trying to make this whole thing work. But again, I mean, we're going to jump over that. You might just, maybe I'd said enough about it, you'll sit down and read it tonight. Genesis chapter 32, verses 22. Here we have the story of Jacob's name changing. You notice, now with Isaac, that was not the case, but with Abraham, you know, he started out Abram and then became Abraham, and here you have Jacob becoming Israel. But notice the events, you know, verse 22, and he arose that night and took his two wives and his two maidservants and his 11 sons and crossed over to ford at Chabak. When I was in Israel, we went to that location. And just think of the the logistics and the complications. Two wives and two handmaidens and 11 sons. I mean, this was quite a project. And he took them and sent them over the brook and sent them over what he had and sent over what he had had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. So he had sent them across, and he stayed, and he had this wrestling match. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." You see, he was struggling with the one who would later become Jesus Christ. The narrative here, when you look at it, is about very real people and a very real God who literally was in contact with them. That's why when, you know, you philosophize or spiritualize or etherealize, whatever word you might want to use, the words of the Bible, it loses its impact and effectiveness. Here, Jacob literally struggled with God, and it resulted in a big change. His name would now be Israel. Then Jacob asked him, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "What is that to you? Ask about my name." And he blessed him there, and Jacob named the place Peniel, "For I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved." Just as he crossed over Penuel, the sun rose on him, and he limped on his hip. Therefore, to this day, the children of Israel do not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank, and he limped for the rest of his life. His name changed. Jacob became Israel, and that became the name of the nation that he fathered, and the descendants that would be many. And of course, you know, this time he had 11 sons, later there would be more, or two more. Now let's go to number 32. And again, you know, we kind of jump across some things. But Let's take a look at Joseph being sold into slavery. Genesis chapter 37. See what I... You have Joseph dreaming of greatness, and you have sibling rivalry, and they get jealous of what might be. And you look at it, and you know, they felt threatened by him. You know, people react in that kind of way when they feel, when they are insecure and feel threatened. Verse 12, then his brothers went to feed their father's flocks in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, Are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to them, here I am. And he said to him, please go see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him there, and he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? And he said, I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. Notice what they said. Look, this dreamer is coming. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. They were insecure, so they conspired to get rid of him. But when Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So Reuben is trying to mitigate the problem and said, hey, come on, let's throw him in a pit. And his purpose was that, you know, you get all the brothers out of there, and then he come and pull him back out. Well, Reuben was the oldest, was the firstborn, and he should have been a little bit more, taken that responsibility more seriously, and not played politics. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. Then we come up with a brilliant idea. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come on, let's make some money here. You know, this, you know, the Jewish tendency toward making money is a generational genetic trait, isn't it? It was Judah that came up with the notion, why, let's not kill him. You know, we can get some money. Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. You know, let's not be guilty of murder. It's much better that we engage in slave trade here. And his brothers listened. I mean, sure. Then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and he took Joseph to Egypt. He was sold into slavery. Now, Joseph, you know, if you look at the story here, Joseph is a story in itself. You know, he was sold into slavery out of spite of his brothers, and then he had an opportunity to work for a very high-ranking official in Egypt, and then he got thrown into prison out of no fault of his own. And what I find amazing in that story is that every time when you read this, and the Lord was with Joseph, you know, this is kind of like, you know, his friends like this, who needs enemies? You know, with a God like this, who needs him? You know, and the Lord was with Joseph, and the Lord was with Joseph. You see that again and again. Of course, God had a purpose, but I think there was also a maturing process. Joseph had to be this before he could become the ruler and be tempered so that he was able to do what God intended for him to do. And of course, you know the story of Joseph's brothers coming to Egypt and begging and falling down before him. And the words of the dream came true, didn't they? The prophecy was true. We go over to Genesis chapter 46. Point number, this is Israel in Egypt, number 33. This is after they all came back to Canaan and told Israel or Jacob the truth that Joseph was still alive. In verse 28, we notice, I will go and see him before I die. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to God, to the God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here I am. And he said, I am the God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones, and their wives in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry them, and he took their livestock and their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him. Now, this was quite a journey, and quite a story of fate. Precisely what they had tried to prevent from happening occurred. And the lesson is, you know, we can't go against the will of God because, you know, we just get crushed. That's why we need to pray, Thy will be done. Now we jump over to Genesis chapter 49, you know, after Jacob had been in Egypt. He was on his deathbed and pronounced a blessing in the form of a prophecy to his sons. And notice how it is prefaced here. In verse 1, And Jacob called his sons and said, Gather together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days. So that projects way forward to our time, the last days. I mean, you have here, you know, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, but unstable as water you shall not excel. It doesn't sound like a blessing. I want to go down to and take a look at Joseph's blessing in verse 22, and we'll read this, and then I want to go to 1 Chronicles, because here in this passage of Scripture is where there was a distinction made between the birthright and the scepter. Up until that time, those two components of a blessing resided in one person, meaning Jacob. But now if we go down to Joseph. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hand of the mighty God of Jacob. For there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel, by the God of your father who will help you, and by the Almighty who will bless you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts of the womb, blessings of your father, have excelled the blessings of my ancestors up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers, referring to back to when he was separate in Egypt. So that is the blessing that was confirmed upon Joseph. But if you look in Genesis chapter 48, he actually blessed in verse 14. Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who was the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh, guiding his hand knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn. And he blessed Joseph and said, God, before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from evil, bless the lads. Let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Now when Joseph saw his father had laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him, so he took hold of his father's hand to remove it from Abraham's head to Manasseh's. And Joseph said to his father, not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on him. But his father refused and said, I know, my son, I know. He also shall become a people, and he shall be great. But truly the younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations. So he blessed them that day, saying, by you Israel will bless, saying, may God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh. And thus he said, Ephraim before Manasseh. So Ephraim and Manasseh became, even though they were the grandchildren of Israel, the grandsons, rather, of Israel, they became named among the 12. Of course, Levi was the 13th son. Now let's go over to 1 Chronicles chapter 5. First Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1 and 2. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. Yet Joseph prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a ruler, although the birthright was Joseph's. So here we have the definitive statement that Joseph was to become the recipient of the birthright blessing. Now let's go back to Genesis chapter 49. Genesis chapter 49, in verse 8. Judah, you are He whom your brothers shall praise, your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies, your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. For the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion who shall rouse him. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. So all the way up until Shiloh comes, meaning the return of Jesus Christ, the scepter was given to Judah. And that is, I mean, we can expand that into a lengthy discussion. So let's stop there today. Our time is up. And then when we commence again, we will take a look at Israel in slavery in Egypt and Moses' birth.